Good morning, everybody. My name is Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. How you all doing? Yeah, I would like to start out by asking my son, Chris, and his wife, Joy, to stand up. I'm delighted that they came down to be with me, and welcome to the... First of all, I want to thank the committee, and it's been a wonderful event. As all things in California are, it's really a treat to come out here, and it's been a great weekend. We've had some wonderful speakers. So I want to get into my talk, my story, basically divided into two parts. What happened during the years that I drank, and what I thought happened during the years that I drank. Since it's a Sunday morning meeting, I plan to talk on the second step and God as I understand him this morning. And I enjoy doing that, and I'll get into it, but it takes a while. When I see an audience this big, and there's a lot of military, I know there's, when they mentioned the Marine Corps the other night, half the audience came unglued, so I know that there has to be some... And I'm still looking for a guy who, if you're in the audience, then you'll recognize yourself. And so this is just a two-second here thing for a commercial. You were a Navy lieutenant commander in 1964, and you and I were both locked up in the nut ward of the Bethesda Naval Hospital. And you didn't like me because I was a Marine. And during clay class, it was clear that I had made the best ashtray. It was just... Everyone else in the nut ward conceded that I had won. It was, we were just waiting for the doctor to do the final judging, but we knew it was in the bag. And you came into my room the night before the judging with that big cigar, and you pretended it was an accident, but you put that cigar out in my ashtray, knocked it on the floor, and it broke, and you won the contest of the best ashtray. And I figured anybody who'd do something like that is probably a drunk, and maybe you got lucky and got into Alcoholics Anonymous, and maybe if you got into Alcoholics Anonymous, you started working your program, and maybe you'd like to do a ninth step on this. Now, I've forgotten about the whole issue myself. But I'll be right up here after the meeting just in case you happen to be around. My friend Keith was our speaker Friday night, and that was a real pleasure to see him. I hadn't seen him in a long time. And it's something funny. As I listened to his talk, I was reminded of when I was... probably from 17 through 19, 20, somewhere in those years, I worked construction. I was a steeplejack, and I worked for this friend of mine whose uncle had a great saying. He would always come around after we'd done something particularly stupid, and he would say to us, "You know, you guys, I've learned you everything I know, and you still don't know nothing." And there was something about Keith's story Friday night that as his sponsor, I had the feeling, I've learned him everything I know, and he still doesn't know anything. Because he stood up there and blatantly informed us that he just lost his job and he was going to get married. And so I got thinking about that maybe Keith and I are the dumbest people that I've run across in a long time. I mean, you know, we've done some dumb things. I look back over the Marine Corps years and some of the dumb things we've done in sobriety, and I came to the conclusion, thinking about it overnight, that we may be two of the dumbest guys that I've run across in a long time, with the possible exception of everyone in this room who's asked us to come and speak. And listening to all our words. You notice, if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, it's funny who you end up listening to and how the deal works when you come into the program. Outside, they look at your degrees and they see if you've got some company and you're famous or this or that. And it's the farther you've gone up, the more attention you get. But in AA, it's the farther you've gone down, the more attention that you get. You know what I'm talking about? There'll be a discussion meeting and they'll go, well, Joe, what do you think about that? And you say, well, I've been arrested 10 times and I think that we probably around. Well, Frank, what about you? He says, well, I've been arrested 20 times. And everybody shifts their attention to Frank because he obviously has recovered from a greater depth and he's greater proof that this is working. So whereas we were minimizing our drinking before we got here, all of a sudden we're exaggerating the amount of trouble that we got into. And if you keep track of us speakers over the years, you'll notice what I'm talking about. We're kind of like a golfer who finally broke 80, shot 79. He comes in, they say, what did you shoot? He says, 78. You just can't say the actual truth. There's always a little bit of stretching that goes on from time to time. Let's see, I had two other things I was going to get out of the way. I know. Before I get talking about, and I really do want to spend some time talking about this God as I understand him, because to me that's the name of the game in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what's going on in here. It's just like what was going on before we got here was drinking. You know, drinking was the name of the game. And if you hadn't started drinking yet and your friends were drinking, they called you around and they said, this is drinking. And you just got into it. There wasn't any messing around. We just said, the way that drinking works is you drink alcohol. And that's where the power came from to get the job done. And that's what the centerpiece was. And when you get to Alcoholics Anonymous, that's what the deal is here. It's called a higher power. That's the name of the game in AA. And so I just want to share with you my story a little bit, but it's mostly the struggle, and I think that human beings have, in coming to grips with their own personal higher power. My story is probably very similar. You know, I think almost every drunk story could be, I started drinking, got in a lot of trouble, came to AA, and things are a lot better. But we've been assigned, 55 minutes to spend this morning, so you have to stretch that out, but most of the stories look just like that. You know, I started drinking and all these bad things happened, and through some circumstance beyond my own control, I found myself in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm sure those of you that are new, it's a pleasure to be here. God, it's hard to talk after that countdown. I was so choked up when that one day came up here, and we're just looking at the front line of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is it. This is the hand just touching right there. There it was. And we were all here to watch it. And it's just hard to improve on that story. You know what I mean? There's a whole AA talk that just took place right in front of our eyes. And I feel inadequate to improve on that. But we do get here for different reasons. Very few people, I haven't met very many people who said, I was sitting around my living room one night, and I got to thinking about my drinking, and I saw that there was a potential problem down the road if I kept up drinking a few more years. So I just called the operator and said, I'd sure like AA to send some people over, and I'd like to get into praying and character building as soon as possible. I'd like to give up going to the beach and bowling and bike riding and just get into prayer and character building. If you could just get somebody over here right away, it would really make me happy. We seem to get here, each person has their own way that they got here. These days, more recently, we're finding that people get here because a cop raises his hand and says, "Pull over, breathe in here." Now, we say this is a spiritual program, and if you're new, you may not recognize that cop as a spiritual messenger. You probably had a big resentment about him. Why'd he pick me out? All the other drunk drivers out there, and he had to pick on me. And then we'll just wait a while. It may take 6 months, may take a couple of years, but we're going to hear you up at the podium here one day, and you're going to say, "You know, God smiled down on me one day. Had a great big cop jump out in front of my car. There were thousands suffering alcoholics out there in hell. And for some unknown reason, I was singled out to be set free that night." Or it may have been your doctor. Doctors get people into AA, too. They call you in, they say something like, "If I was you, I wouldn't buy any long-playing records." We're going to explain liver damage, and you've got it. We had a guy back in the Washington area, and he always talked about there was one word that got him in when his doctor said this. It got him into Alcoholics Anonymous. For years, he'd do the annual physical and he'd say, "Buck, you better get into AA because you're going to die." And he told him that year after year. And one year, he changed it by one word and he came right in. You know what that word was? Soon. There's a lot of difference between dying and dying soon. It's just... Or maybe your boss was the one. We got a lot of employer programs now, and they very subtly call you in and ask you if you would mind briefing your replacement. And this is... You thought you were getting promoted that day, and another guy has his name tag on your desk. This happens to drunks a lot, you know, just people running our business. Maybe the family did it. You come home, you're looking, there's a lot of activity. Bags packed, people going, they're all excitement, this and that. "Hey, what's going on? Hi, hi." So we all have our little ways of getting into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think my favorite way of story was the... young man that was called up in front of the judge, and the judge said, "Well, you've been arrested 25 times over the last 3 years for being drunk in public, and we got to do something real serious, so it's either one AA meeting or a year in jail." And the guy stood out there, and he was where we find ourselves so often in life, on the horns of a dilemma. And there he sat squirming. One AA meeting or a year in jail. God. One AA meeting or a year in jail. Now, for our non-alcoholic friends, you're probably wondering, what's wrong with this guy? Is he crazy? One AA meeting or a year in jail? What's the problem? What's the problem? Well, the problem is that this guy drank in a bar where lots of other people drank, and they were heavy drinkers like he was. And from time to time, they'd get in trouble, too. And the ones that went to jail came back. So he had a real dilemma. He knew those when those A and A's get you, you just don't see them anymore. So whatever the reason we get here, and I got here through a grand mal seizure in a classroom one day in the Marine Corps studying to be a general something. And that was the end of that. I drank differently than non-alcoholics. I drank because alcohol fixed things. Alcohol did something for me. Clancy talks about that a lot, and I just love the way he just hammers that point home, that what made me different is what alcohol did for me, not so much what it did to me, if that might do things to other people, but it didn't do these things for me. What alcohol basically was my secret to life. It was, without me realizing it, it was my higher power. Vodka ended up being my higher power. And I had a whole program that centered around this higher power. There's a tremendous analogy for me, anyway, between alcohol and a higher power. The whole routine that we go through. We had little meetings in bars all over the place, and we met there on certain nights of the week, and there was the same crowd, and we all talked about drinking, and we drank. And we had this power work on us as a group. And it solved things for me that should have been solved in other fashions. What alcohol was solving for me was growing up. That's basically what I avoided doing and thought I was doing through drinking. Like, I don't think I was that much different from the average teenager wandering around wondering what in the heck is going on. That was the standard question. You know, you're looking around. I mean, you got lots of other things that are catching your attention, but the one that bothered me the most was, where am I supposed to be and what am I supposed to be doing? That was the one that I never was sure of. And probably the toughest question that anyone could ask me in life was, they'd walk up and go, what are you doing here? It was a two-pronged question that I wasn't sure I was supposed to be here, but I knew you're supposed to be somewhere. Remember that guy in the joke, what are you doing in that closet, when he caught the guy in his wife's bedroom? The guy said, everybody got to be somewhere, you know. So I knew everybody had to be somewhere, but I had the feeling that you were supposed to know where you were supposed to be, and you were supposed to know what you were doing and what you were supposed to be doing. And so I was always trying to come up with the answers to these tremendously difficult philosophical questions. We're talking now about the essence of life is, what are you supposed to be doing? Where are you supposed to be? That's why I like the little prayer books that have today's date in there. You know the ones I'm talking about? I like that. I know what page I'm supposed to be on, you know. And I look at the calendar and then I go, I'm supposed to be reading this here prayer. And it gives me that feeling, you know, somebody comes in, what are you doing? I'm reading this. I'm supposed to be reading this today. Why? You got a problem with that? Take a look here. I'm supposed to be reading this. So it's very comfortable if you have that feeling that you're where you're supposed to be and doing what you're supposed to be doing. And that certainly isn't what us as practicing alcoholics were ever engaged in. I mean, how many of us have gone down to the corner to get some laundry soap? Have you ever done that on a Saturday afternoon? Your wife sends you out. I need some laundry soap. Go down. I'll be right back. Now come right back. I'll be right back. Be right back. So, okay. So it's Monday. And you start opening one eye. You ever do that? And you're just going, and there's noises you're not familiar with. Drilling or something like that. And you're going, must be fixing the neighborhood or something. And you get one eye going, and then you look, and there's bright blue drapes. And you go, wrong room, wrong room. I don't live here. So you shut your eyes, and you go, oh, please, 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 and open them again and start looking around and checking it out, and you don't recognize the room, you don't know, and you go, no, another one of these. And here it starts. Well, first we have to identify what city we're in. Look around the room, it's a hotel room, you can finally get on the match pack or the postcards or something. How the hell did I get in Mississippi? I started out in Must have been down looking for Franklin. And then we work our way through it and find out where we are and get the incredible challenges that some of us have of recouping from this gracefully, coming home, explaining how they were out of laundry soap at this store. And you ran into a Tide salesman who said he could get it for you wholesale down in Mississippi. So in the interest of saving the family's budget, you accompanied him to Mississippi. And you know, the funny thing is, sometimes we get people to believe these stories. I don't know if we get them to believe it. I think we just get them to accept it because they just can't go through the anguish of trying to actually find out what happened, and they take the easy way out. But the person that we have the hardest time explaining all this to is ourselves. And that's what was painful about being a human being, about growing up, and about drinking. For some unknown reason, alcohol affected me differently than most people. And what it did, it gave me the sense that with this chemical, I would be all right. And not just today, forever. It was my secret weapon that was somehow specially handed out to me to get through anything that I might encounter. Now, that's called faith. I mean, I really had faith in this stuff because, and you know, a lot of times it did work. Boy, in those early years, that stuff was amazing. You talk about the 14 promises of vodka. I mean, we're talking about there you stand, you're filled with fear, you can't make a decision, you don't know which way to go, and you just walk in and you just say, could I please have some of that secret of life? And we get two or three of those down inside, and pretty soon we intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. Just from somewhere came a clear picture of what was going on. It solves the spiritual dilemmas. I didn't know who I was, what the universe was, what this all was about. And then I'd have about three drinks, and I knew all of it. I could feel it. I just could sense that I was part of something wonderful. If I could just stay at three drinks, that was the trouble. I'd just get over the edge a little bit, you know, on drink 14, where you just started dry heaving or vomiting and lost it all. So there was a problem with drinking, but I knew it was the answer. The only thing I had to perfect was drinking. And there would be those times, I'm sure you have had them, where by a pure quirk, you drank a lot and behaved perfectly. This would happen, you know, statistically. It just happens once in a while where you get a semi-load on, but you're still functioning and you show up where you're supposed to be and you're polite and you're gracious and everything and you don't break bad that night and you go through the whole thing. And I would have those about every 2 years. I'd have one of those things where, and my wife would say to me, you know, if you'd behave like that all the time when you drank, there wouldn't be any problem. And I'd go, right, you know, you're right. This is how I ought to behave all the time. And I would look back on the day. I would try to remember, what time did I set the alarm for? I was going to duplicate the day. Okay, for breakfast? No, I didn't have any breakfast. I never have any breakfast. Well, I had this for lunch. And I would see what I had for lunch, and I'd try to do that the next day. And, of course, you know that there would be no comparison. There was no way that I could get on. But I thought I could. Alcohol to me in many respects was like checking a book out of the library. You know, you walk in there and you feel like an adventure, so you go to the adventure section and you get a spy novel or something and you look at the cover and you go, you know, this looks like a good book. And you take it home, but until you read it, you really don't experience the book. It's just sitting on your table and you're going, you know, that's going to be a hell of an adventure. I'm going to get into that book. And then finally when you read it, boy, you go over here and you're in Poland and then you're coming across here into China and then you're here and you're in an airplane and you're just having marvelous adventure, but you had to read it in order to do it. And I felt the same way. It was almost like I went over to the liquor store and checked out a bottle. And I'd take it home and I'd hold it up to the light and I'd look at it and I could shake it and I could smell it and I'd go, I wonder what's in store for me in here. You know, it's like... And you just didn't know. I mean, you could look at that label and you could go back and you could have had one the night before, a bottle of this vodka, and it turned into being one of the happiest nights. You stayed with your buddies, you played cards, and you just shot the breeze all night. It was one of those great nights. And you went back and you bought the bottle next to it in the case and brought it home the next night. And you looked at it and the guys are around. You said, hey, let's have another night like last night. Only that's not what they sold you that night. They sold you go-to-jail whiskey. And you... And you sat at your table, the same bottle and the whole thing. You poured it in, and all of a sudden, coming in, your teeth are knocked out, and you're in the jail. You almost feel like going back to the liquor store and going, I told you what I wanted. I wanted that stuff from that I had last night. It was like... You talk about turning your life over to the care of. That's what I literally did with alcohol. I think a lot of us do. We have made a decision to turn our lives over to the care of this particular higher power because I had faith in it. Yeah, there were some ragged edges in it, but basically this was my friend because of what it did to me. It solved a lot of problems. It made me feel like I knew what I was doing. I was where I was supposed to be. When I was drinking, I knew I was doing what I was supposed to be doing. I mean, that you never, as I poured that first drink down, never did I go, you know, I don't think I need a second drink. I never had that feeling. As soon as that drink hit, it was like, I'm where I'm supposed to be. I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And anybody comes in here, I can look them right in the eye and I can say, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. It was almost like free at last, free at last. I'm right here where I'm supposed to be. The problem with all of this was not the method. I think I was on to something. I was on to the real secret to life, which is, you can't get through life on your own. I think that's one of the great secrets of life is you cannot expect to be able to get through life on your own resources. And that's where alcohol came in. It was, yeah, that's right. You can't get through. You need some extra power beyond yourself. And that's what I was getting out of alcohol. So I was on to the right answer. I was on to the right technique for living life. So us alcoholics, I think we're pretty good detectives in figuring out how life worked. The problem was we got a bad higher power. That's about what I would say about vodka. I don't know about your higher power, but my alcohol higher power, I have this sneaky feeling today, in retrospect, didn't really love me. That's what I feel. That's just, I mean, who knows how vodka really feels? I mean, there's no way to know. We could discuss it all night. Does vodka have a soul? And I don't know. We could get into that. But to me, that was the only thing wrong with my philosophy of life. I had the wrong higher power. That's it. That was it. I had the right concept that life was too much for me. We weren't supposed to be able to get through totally on our own. And you know, when I got to AA, that's what you started telling me. I can just very briefly tell you that I drank in the Marine Corps for almost all the years that I drank. I flew airplanes for the Marine Corps, was out here at El Toro many years ago and had a lot of fun, flew overseas and in jet fighters. And at the end of 12 or 13 years of flying, the alcoholism got so bad that I didn't trust the pilot of the plane I was in. He was shaking, his hands were like this, he was losing the vision, he could get in the wrong plane from time to time, and the plane captain, no, captain, you're supposed to be in the, oh, yeah, all right, and go over and get in the other airplane, and did some things, and got kind of frightening, and so on down, and had blackouts, withdrawals, and all those things flying, and I've met a lot of pilots since then, and we know what they were doing, they were drinking and flying, and that was the answer. That's why they lasted longer than I did. I was trying to withdraw and fly. And that was stupid. And I started out telling you, you're listening to a dumb speaker, and you are. That was a very dumb thing to have done, because that makes your hands shake, and you're losing vision, you're sweating, and heart palpitations, and all of that. And so when I turned myself into the doctor, they examined me. Back in the dark ages, we didn't even have alcoholism as a diagnosis in the Navy. You couldn't have alcoholism. And so the doctors diagnosed me after examining me for 2 weeks and seeing the high blood pressure, the eyes that looked like the rising sun. That's why I was so popular in Japan when I was over there. The shaky hands, the sweating in the wintertime, all of those things, and the diagnosis. They couldn't find anything physically, so they left it up to the psychiatrist, and he diagnosed it as a childhood fear of flying that was just now manifesting itself after 11 years or so in the cockpit. So what they did with this Marine who could no longer fly and was in this horrible shape was to make me an air traffic controller. And so I spent the last 2 years of my drinking bringing planes in the bad weather when they couldn't see the runway. And I will not tell you these. There may be some pilots in the audience. You'll black out or pass out if I told you how many planes I would see when it was just you. You got another plane, 12 o'clock, 1 mile. I don't see him. I don't see him. Oh, no, you don't. He's gone now. Blink my eyes and there's only one plane. If you're a pilot, you know you're in trouble when you come in and the air traffic controller is going like this. Turn right, turn left. When you got two center lines, you got a problem. I never heard that one before myself. And Mary's making me laugh down here. Oh, well, enough of that. What happened at the end was I did end up with the seizures and the grand mal seizures, malnutrition and so on down. And in the nut ward in 1964, I guess we'd been there about 3 months, and there was no AA. AA had been in the Navy hospital and then got thrown out. They thought they were doing damage. And they had talked their way back in while we were there, and the redheaded guy came in and talked his way into having an AA meeting there. So I came to AA because a corpsman came into the nut ward and said, "All drunks fall in." And left face, right face, down the hall, and that's how I got to AA. 3 months later, after I got out as an outpatient, I drank again for a couple of weeks and then called AA on my own and got this big sponsor who's still my sponsor, is another Marine. And all I'll tell you about him is that he filled the doorway to my house when I went to get it. You know, it was like, yes, yes. And he just looked down with that shaved head and just said, "Hi, my name is Bill. This is a 12-step call. You listen, I talk." So it was very basic, solid AA. And for the longest time, I thought the first step was get in a car. You know, Bill, I don't want to go to a meeting tonight. Get in the car. I'd say, okay, I'll get in the car and then I'll talk him out of it. So we stayed, went to meeting every night and for the longest time, and that got my indoctrination into this program and got us off and running, and lots of things have happened in sobriety. I got thrown out of the Marine Corps after going to a meeting every night for 2 years. That didn't seem fair. Anybody else had things unfair happen in their sobriety? That seemed to this day, one of the more unusual things. Go to a meeting every night for 2 years, and then you're out. And I remember talking to people at discussion meetings. Rarely do I raise my hand at a discussion meeting when the leader says, anybody have a topic? But I figured, if you go to a meeting every night for 2 years and you get thrown out of the Marine Corps, this is a unique topic. So I raised my hand, and he said, yes. And I said, well, I went to a meeting every night for 2 years and I got thrown out of the Marine Corps. Oh, you'd like to discuss getting thrown out of the Marine Corps. Well, everybody, the topic tonight, getting thrown out of the Marine Corps. So we start around the room. The first guy says, getting thrown out of the Marine Corps? Serenity prayer. And I remember looking at him. The guy was probably in the Army, you know. The reason I wanted the topic was I needed a job, and he's telling me the serenity prayer. Next guy said, double up on your meetings. And I said, double up on my meetings? He says, yeah, you got a lot of time. Next guy said, prayer St. Francis. Prayer St. Francis, the best thing you can ever work. And the last guy said, find some new guy, go work with him. And that was the answer to getting thrown out of the Marine Corps. About 8 years later, my whole marriage is breaking up. Very painful. 6 kids, and I'm moving out, somebody else is moving in. I don't think it's fair. Stay sober for 8 years. I thought you were supposed to get rich. That was the second time I raised my hand at a meeting. Anybody got a top? Yeah, getting thrown out of your own house. Getting thrown out of your own house. Sandy wants to discuss getting thrown out of your own house. Why don't we have the topic tonight, getting thrown out of your own house? First guy said, thrown out of the house, serenity prayer. That's what you need. Next guy says, you got nowhere to go. Go to double up on your meetings. Next guy says, prayer St. Francis, and the last guy said, find somebody new, work with them. And the only other time I had my hand up was 5 years later. I had gotten into real estate, the money market dried up, no mortgage rent. Now bankruptcy is coming. You're not supposed to do that when you got 13 years of sobriety. So I got my hand up, bankruptcy, you know, right? You already know. You already know. Guess what the advice was? Serenity prayer. So they went through the whole litany, and so that leads me into what I'd like to talk about, which is this higher power. Because you just heard me go through like a broken record. Whenever problem you raise up, you keep hearing the same answer. Have you noticed that about AA? I finally figured out, now you got to listen to this, this is why a lot of my pigeons stop calling me up. They get tired of not following the same advice. I'm not going to call him. All he's going to tell me is. So I'm a great subscriber to Clancy and the Aha machine, you know. You don't need to listen to that because you know what the answer is going to be. So what do we got in here is an answer. That's what we got. That's what we got here is an answer. We have a solution. And it's a solution that's different than any of the other solutions we ever got involved in because it's a spiritual solution and a spiritual program. Everything seems to work backwards. And you learned that when you first came in. Oh, you're trying to beat alcoholism? Surrender. And you're going, well, that seems the backwards way. I'm trying to beat alcoholism. You're telling me to surrender. How can you possibly win by surrendering? Well, look at the Japanese. And this is... role models right there. There's so many of these paradoxes. And I suppose that what sobriety consists of, at least the way I'm thinking about it today, is... it's a tremendous change in perspective. When you think about it, if you were to describe when you first arrived here or back in your drinking days, if I were to describe to you the universe, you know what I mean? If you came up to me and said, let's have some esoteric philosophical concepts here. Now, how would you describe the universe? Here's how I would have described it. The universe. Well, first there's me. I had a terrible childhood. I have these limitations. I have these strengths. I have certain problem areas, struggles. Oh, just to get to know me is quite a thing, I'll tell you that. Here's some of my major problems. People intimidate me. I'm fear-ridden, guilt-ridden. I had a Catholic, what do you expect? I have this. I have that. I have this. I have that. And then there's the rest of the universe. And that would be how I would describe the universe. If I would put it on a blackboard, there would be a big me. Rest of the universe would be over here in little small letters. And that's how I looked at everything. There was me and the rest of the universe. And mostly there was me. There was a song I remember in World War II. It was called Poor Johnny One Note. It was some swing song. I think I can remember the Andrews sisters singing it or something like that. But it's called Poor Johnny One Note. And the only thing I remember about it was I think it was a clarinet player that he only could play one note and he couldn't get a job in a band. And he said, poor Johnny One Note, he'd go, beep, you know, and this sort of weepy sound would come out. And that was it. That was the total note he could play. And it reminded me of me. The one note that I knew how to play whenever you'd come around to talk to me about the universe was me. Well, enough about God. Let's talk about me. I heard something. I was in a movie the other night. Joanne and I were at this movie, and I forget what it was. Well, enough about me. What do you think about me? That was the line in the... That was the line in the movie, was... What do you think about me? So I don't want to say that we're self-centered or that we spend a lot of time thinking about ourselves and how, what's going on. You know, it's getting too hot in the room. It's too smoky. On the chair's too thin. How long is this going to last? Are we going out there? I mean, we're just keeping track of everything about me. And we come in the program, we go, our problem is self-centeredness. And you say, right, I concur. I agree that the problem is self-centeredness. And you know what a self-centered person says immediately after that? I'm going to do something about that. I'm going to become less self-centered. So there you are, on your own, becoming less self-centered. Let's see. I'm going to stop doing this. I'm going to look at things this way. Well, you start going around in this circle and you find you are becoming more self-centered as you focus in on your self-centeredness. And you're going nowhere fast, which is what's self-centered. So you start thinking about it. You ever start thinking, what's the opposite of self-centered? Maybe we could get out of our dilemma by figuring out what the opposite of self-centered is. And you can work on that until the cows come home. But when you get in the program, you find out the opposite is God-centered. That's the only way to become unself-centered is to have the center around something else. And so when this was all presented to me, you got to realize that there's a whole bunch of us, probably 98.2%, who arrive in here who are intellectually superior to everyone else who has arrived here or will arrive, and we want to change the steps, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do that. And so I heard all what was going on in here, that these 12 steps were how you stay sober, and Franklin went through them in such a beautiful fashion last night. They're the perfect roadmap for sobriety. If you follow these 12 steps, yes, they will take you there. And you know something? I conceded all that, which I always did. I never argued with anyone who's had a plan that worked. I didn't say these 12 steps wouldn't work. I just thought there had to be another way. Yeah, that's one of the ways that'll work. I agree. If somebody wants to turn their life over to God and go down these 12 steps and stay the straight and narrow, They will get there. It was just like I was taught in grammar school, how to study. They said, you want to get high grades? You go home every night and you study 10 minutes on every course every night. You will be guaranteed an A. And you know something? I did it once, and I got all A's. I studied 10 minutes every night, and then I said, well, that's interesting. That certainly works. Now, let's get into some experimenting. How few classes can you go to and still get a passing grade? Could you not even show up for an entire semester and still get? Could you just study for 9 straight hours the night before the final? And I mean, we already had done the research on the straight and narrow. We already knew that. What we needed were pioneers. We needed people out there researching. What we need... are people testing the outer limits of the straight and narrow? Now, why do we spend so much time getting away from the straight and narrow? The straight and narrow looks boring. You know what guys do who are on the straight and narrow? I saw guys on the straight and narrow. Guy who follows the straight and narrow. Let me show you what a guy who follows the straight and narrow. This is what he does. God, it's really embarrassing. They get up in the morning, they go right to work. They stay on their job all day. They work real hard. They get in their car, they go home that night to their family. And they stay there. And they're nice to their kids. And then they go to bed like maybe 11 o'clock at night to get a good night's rest, to get up in the morning and go to work again the next day. I remember looking at people like that and going, boy, I sure feel sorry for that guy. He's sort of... that's going to be all he'll ever see for the rest of his life, is that alarm clock going off and one foot in front of the other and down the straight and narrow. Probably if you're new, you've read our big book. It says we're trudging the happy road to destiny and the thing. Trudging? Straight and narrow? I mean, you know, there's no massage parlors down the straight and narrow. They're all over there. Anybody can do that. And that was the big lie. Anybody could do that. See, I tried that. I was trying to live with spiritual values without a higher power. So any of you that are new, if you found that you consistently couldn't live up to your own values, it's because you were trying to do it without a higher power. You're trying to be a spiritual person on your own, which is what a self-centered person would do. Anybody can be spiritual with God. But wouldn't you really be somebody if you could do it without Him? Boy, then they'd sit around and notice me. Then they'd go, there's a real man. He's become spiritual on his own. And so in a literal sense, we are our own higher power. You know what I mean? We're just, and that was the dilemma, the old idea that I had gotten locked into through all of this stuff, whatever it was. That's how I figured life out, that in order to be somebody, you had to do it on your own. I came here and you told me that I'm going to have to engage in this struggle in our second step of the great debate about whether we're going to have a higher power or not. And I think every newcomer is one of the most crucial phases you can go through is your own personal debate on this higher power God issue, which you're going to get confronted with as soon as you walk in the door, because you're going to find that you've admitted you're powerless over alcohol, and once you've done that, you've started down the spiritual road. Because if you're powerless over it, you can't learn your way out of powerlessness. The only answer to being powerless is a higher power. Then you go back and go, maybe I better rewrite step one. I seem to be walking into an intellectual dead-end canyon here if I'm admitting that I'm powerless. But that's exactly what we've done. When I got my big book, my sponsor wanted me to read it all over the place, and I've told this story before, that I wasn't interested in that. I was already thinking up my own program. I'd only been in here a month. But I knew he'd be all over my case, so I took the big book home and did what I call massaging the big book. You take it and you rub pages around, and then you get a coffee cup and make some coffee stains all around on the thing there. And then get one of those felt tip on different pages, and wow, this is important, reread this. And then if he ever came around and you said, he's a big, let me show you, here's something that really caught my attention one day, and show him this and that. And while I was flipping through the book, I saw the chapter of the agnostic, which has to do with our second step, and I figured that I knew what was in there without reading it. So many of us know ahead of time, without trying things, whether they'll work or not, and I knew what was in that chapter without reading it. I knew that the chapter of the agnostic was, for those of us that are agnostics, how to stay sober without a higher power. That's what I knew was in that chapter, even though I hadn't read it yet. So I knew in the back of my mind that someday I would read that chapter, and that's where all the knowledge would be for me as an agnostic on how to stay sober. And if you're new, I can save you a lot of time reading that chapter. I can summarize it in, 3 words. Change your mind. That's what the chapter to the... Basically what the chapter suggests is becoming a former agnostic. That's what the whole chapter is about. And the reason it's being suggested, and now we're going to get into the real intellectual, spiritual part of the program. There's a great old story about Jack Benny when he had a radio show, and it was supposed to be one of the funniest lines he ever got was walking down a hallway, and all you heard was just his footsteps just going thump, 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 and then you heard a voice go, "Stick 'em up." And Benny, of course, didn't want to part with a penny, and he made a little yipe, and then there was this dead silence for a while, and the stick-up man said, "Your money or your life?" And then it got real quiet and stayed quiet for like 25 seconds. And the audience started laughing louder and louder and louder. And he's just standing there. And finally the stick-up man said, "Well," and Benny said, "I'm thinking." And it's a very humorous moment to be looking on these things. And I think this is the same problem that we have when we get to the second step. And the big book talks about to live on a spiritual basis or to die an alcoholic death, not always easy alternatives to face. And that's where we are in the second step. We've just taken our first step, which is the functional equivalent of admitting there's no hope, that this is the end of the world, I'm powerless over alcohol. I kid around back home and I say, the way the first step ought to be dramatically introduced into this program is to take the new person up in a helicopter and maybe get him up to 20,000 feet and go, "Look, we'd like to really explain the program to you. Put on this little headset so that we can talk to you by radio," and push him out. And we're going, "Okay, you get the feeling of powerless. How's the powerless feeling going?" "Yeah, I get the feeling of powerless." And you're going, "Well, we're about to get into the spiritual part of the program here. And we're talking about hitting bottom. And that's what alcohol, the disease, does. It takes us, and when we first start out, we don't see that bottom coming. We're closing through the clouds. We're zooming around. We're going, hey, this is what the skydivers do. Look at this. I did a loop-de-loop. Yeah. Now the parking lot starts looming into vision. And we go, hey, no more room for loops, so I guess any second, right, and it's coming up. And all of a sudden we realize this is serious. It's a serious problem going on, and you are in the middle of your first step. And that's when AA comes in and hits you with our second step, and a great big hand comes down and grabs you just before you hit the truck. And it stops, and you just go, and there you are. And a big voice said, "Excuse me, sir, we're conducting a survey. Do you believe in God?" And that you are now on the doorway to the second step. You now can begin your debate.
And if you like a lot of us, you go, no, but I'm willing to reconsider under these circumstances. And if you're willing to reconsider, you are now developing what we call an open mind. And you thought that an open mind was an intellectual process, and it's really a process of pain. And there it was. Alcohol took us down, and it stands patrolling this parking lot as we speak. There are hundreds of thousands of little bottles of vodka, half pints. So I know the new people, you probably haven't been told about this yet. But they patrol around AA meetings all over the world, hidden in the grass. They're just down there, like little soldiers. And that's because we don't have to keep you here. We don't have any power over you. It's not up to us to keep you here. You know what keeps you here? They do. Because as soon as you walk out and say, I don't need AA anymore, then one of them pops up. Hi. Hi. And you look down, you go, my God, a half pint of my favorite brand. Must be God's will. So we pour it down, and then we start getting spiritual again. And this stuff starts beating us and beating us and beating us until we're willing to surrender. And that is what opens the door to this program. When I say myself a God as I understand him, it is simply what arrived when I asked for help. There's no other definition I've ever had to come up with. I was put in a spot where I finally had to ask for help, unconditional help. And what arrived was beyond the wildest expectations. What I have now is a different perspective. I see the wonderful room here and this whole universe and feel that I'm a little part of it. And that makes me magnificent because I'm just a part of something incredibly big and beautiful. I think when we get close to the higher power, we get a view of the world that we can't possibly get on our own. But on the other hand, I seem to take it back from time to time all throughout the day, and sometimes we'll do it for longer periods, and I get a view of how the world looks without this higher power. And you know, the contrast between those two seems to reinforce the reality of this God. It is incredible to realize when I take the glasses off and look around with just me and the world, what a intimidating place it is, where I don't know who I am, what I'm doing, or where I'm supposed to be. And then I put them back on, and there it is. And I see who you are, who I am, and I see everything as clear as a bell with this higher power. And then I take off and I look and I go, what? And I see that truth saying, the allness of God and the nothingness of self. And it's those two perspectives that I think we're forced, the more we move along in sobriety, it's faster and faster. I'm taking it back a little bit, but then I realize, God, this is ridiculous. And back to this higher power, that I start seeing truths and visions that I've never dreamed existed. And if you're new, let me just close by saying what I think you will see is what a magnificent person you are. That young man, Michael, I think his name was, who got the big book. In that book is a portrait of you, and it will be disclosed to you as you read those pages. And you're going to find out that you are one of the more beautiful people in this room. And the more you read that, and the more you strip away the untruths that are all you're familiar with right now about yourself, you're going to find in there is the essence of all of us, which is the child of God, one of the most beautiful creations that's ever been made, but the only way we can see it is through the eyes of this higher power. So thank you for having me here this morning. It's been a pleasure to be with you, and I look forward to seeing you again.